Hello and welcome to Mansplaining. I'm Stephen Kersner. Today we're going to talk about leadership, and we've got quite a panel assembled for this discussion. Got in Vancouver our producer Hafiz Noorani. Hello, Hafiz.
Hello, hello.
Good to have you. In Vancouver, Paul Doroshenko. Hello, Paul.
Hello, nice to talk to everybody.
Also in Vancouver, Andrew Willis. Hey, Andy, welcome back.
Hi, sorry. That damn mute button of mine. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good. We're glad to have you back. And from La Belle Provence is Aaron Seal. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, everyone. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. We've got our resident MC, Illtones, Chris Hamilton. Hello, Chris.
Hey, what's up, Stephen? How you doing, man?
Good to have you. And from the wilds of outside Edmonton on his hobby farm, where we were just discussing the plague of beavers, is David Lisney. Hello, David.
Thanks for having me. The irony is I live in Beaver County, but that's a whole different discussion.
Well, if you live in Beaver County, then I think that you guys are the interlopers, not the beavers.
Sure. Let's go along with that.
All right. I think there was once a magazine called Beaver County, but it didn't have a lot of articles. All right.
It's horrible. But anyways.
But that was a lead balloon.
I thought it was great. I just, you know, was just imagining it. So it spent a minute or so in my head.
Well, you and I, Paul, were around in the golden age of magazines.
Yes, that's true.
All right. Today we're going to talk about leadership because, I mean, it's something that men are grappling with these days, how to be good leaders and still be good people, because so many of the qualities that traditionally have been associated with leadership have been male qualities, and the qualities that are linked, you know, mostly to aggressive turf war type behavior. So leadership and masculinity have been bound up together for generations, and we're now trying to unravel that as more and more women get into leadership positions. Some of them adopt male behaviors out of necessity. Others don't, and it becomes something of a roadblock for them at times. But we're trying to separate the notion of leadership and masculinity and look at leadership from different perspectives. But to start with, let's talk about what, in our minds, each of us, traditional leadership meant as associated with masculinity. Paul, I mean, you're of a vintage, same as me. We grew up with a certain notion of what leadership was. What was leadership to you when you were growing up?
You know, I was thinking about this over the week. I think about how much it changed over the course of my lifetime and become more defined. So, you know, it was pretty nuanced. When I think of leadership people I would have admired, men I would have admired for their leadership skills, they were pretty balanced for the most part overall. They didn't come off as the strong man, you know, and like I think I lived in a more progressive world, right, in many respects 30 years ago or even 40 years ago, that there was this desire to distance oneself from the strong man leader role. And we've now got more of a dichotomy, I think. And I think we can get into that later in the discussion. But, you know, the men that I admired, I mean, you know, Peter Lougheed was a pretty balanced guy. And I admired him for his leadership skill and, you know, as a politician. And I think of political leaders for that. And then I think of managers I worked with, you know, it was the balanced guys who I admired generally, not the guys who were, you know, take a stand and be an angry dude.
It's interesting because when I grew up, I just look at the books on leadership that were written usually by successful sports coaches and successful businessmen who, you know, people like Ted Turner, people like Phil Knight, you know, management gurus like Tom Peters, people like Lee Iacocca. And to this day, there's still books on leadership written by men who you would consider alpha males. And if you read their books, and I read some of them, some of it was fairly brutal. It was, you know, it was raping and pillaging, updated. And was about denying feelings and denying their validity and denying the weakness of employees, getting rid of them if they were weak. And there was a lot of emphasis on strength, as defined by strong, as defined by people not having any particular emotions.
Well, it's kind of a military management method.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think of in a situation of war, those are all of the, you know, all of those weakness things are things that we have to push aside for the moment to deal with the you know, extreme aspect of combat. And you're not going to spend a lot of time trying to go through everybody's emotions at that time. You end up, unfortunately, dealing with it after the fact. It's not, you know, something you want. But yeah, I suppose most of those management books would have been like that. But that's not necessarily what I saw with the managers I worked with. Certainly not the ones I admired and the ones who were successful.
Okay.
You know, I saw lots of really good managers. Now, I've seen since in the last 10 or 15 years, some really bad examples of sort of leadership management, you know, being a good leader. There's examples that I never expected to see.
Okay.
In my lifetime, you know, the Jason Kenney and Donald Trump. I didn't expect that those types of demagogue leaders would come back in style. I thought we had, you know, thrust that away from our type of democracy. I thought it was no longer going to ever appear again. You know, I look at these, like, I look at these people as, I think they're fascists, they're authoritarian, and they're, you know, we could all sit and list all the problems that we have with them, I suppose, but I did not expect that sort of attitude to reemerge in Canada or the United States as a real thing. And here it is.
Interesting. Okay.
I think with the United States, you kind of would expect it.
Well, the U.S. is all about business, and it's their type of business is often a predatory kind of business, which is not enough for me to succeed.
Well, all business is predatory. All business is predatory to some extent, unless you've either got a monopoly or you're just satisfied with your, you know, drudging along. If you want to try and do better, you're probably taking some business from somebody else who's competing with you.
Well, but there's a difference between you wanting to business win and wanting everybody else to lose.
True.
That, you know, there's
being malicious. Like, exactly. if you look at that Gordon Gekko mindset that was out in the 80s, it never went away. Like, it got softened by the late 90s and into the 2000s, we started questioning it.
But was it a comic book character?
No,
I mean, I didn't know anybody who was like.
Oh,
that.
I work with people in finance. I've worked with people in tech. They're people that try to exemplify these attitudes they see. Like, even Steve Jobs, he was a complete asshole. Like, he was not nice to people. Bill Gates was not nice to people. And when it came down to the actual running off people, you'd see two sides to a lot of these people. You'd see, you know, the public side, which might have been a little bit softer, but, you know, definitely a strong tone. But then you saw the person, or you didn't get to see the person that was in the mix of the situation. And you know what? We're coming from the tech world and whatnot. You still see younger men trying to replicate that. And the best thing to do is nip it in the bud and put them in their place and make them look like a joke, because it doesn't fucking fly.
Interesting. I'd like to get your perspective on this, Aaron. What were the hallmarks of leadership that were masculine in nature when you were growing up?
Yeah, I've had a very interesting trajectory on this, because when you've worked on Parliament Hill, you get to see some of these guys up close. I worked for three ministers, Harper himself, Jim Flaherty, and Tony Clement, and they were all male leaders and had male leadership models, but they were all very different. And if I think about them one by one, Harper himself, I would say, is a thought leader. He's the one who crafts the plan. He's not the one you're going to chit-chat with over the water cooler on Monday morning about your weekend, but you will strategize with him about the week to come. He will think very deeply about what you say if he respects you, and he will craft the ideas together in a way that guides the group. As I say, for me, he's the thought leader. Flaherty, for me, was the people leader. He's the one who'll remember you, remember your face, remember your story, remember the beer he had with you 20 years ago at some dive bar, and he's the one who will inspire you to better because of an emotional connection. My model for him is sort of Jed Bartlett in the West Wing episode where he visits Josh at the O'Hare Airport because his father just died. Flaherty is the guy who'll do that. And meanwhile, Tony Clement, for me, he's the creative leader. He's the one strumming the guitar who wants to think the big thought that comes next. He's the one who wants to figure out what's new. And if I think about him in the time that I knew him over the 3 years, it's a shame for me that he wasn't foreign affairs minister, because that's where his creative side would have shone through. So as I say, three men, three male political leaders, but each distinct. And if I contrast that in my personal experience to women leaders, I actually realized this very recently in my life, thinking back to the job that I had in my late high school years in a call center called Vox Data in Montreal, where I worked for a couple of years as an agent and eventually became a floor supervisor. It was in fact a women-led company. When I became a floor supervisor, my entire chain of command above me was three women. And that shaped my personal experience in a way that I didn't even realize at the time, and now only think through by comparison to later. And if I use an example of what that meant to me, the dominance behaviors in that workplace were very rare, but when one of the women in the chain of command needed to correct a problem, it was corrected swiftly and unambiguously in a way that felt different than some of the male-led workplaces. So those are the experiences that guide me. As I say, it's entirely individual, but there are gendered elements on both sides.
Interesting. How about you, David? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think everybody's kind of touched on what they grew up with as leadership, so I'll briefly throw in that, yeah, like growing up in the 80s, the image of leadership was more of a militaristic, my way or the highway, get in line, barking orders sort of leadership. But yeah, definitely over the decades, I've learned the best way of kind of constructing it, there's managers and then there's leaders. Like leadership is the most effective leaders are going to have a vision of where they are in whatever the organization is, if it's a business, a religious leader, political leader. They have a vision of who they are within that organization, and they have a vision that's large enough to encompass everybody in a constructive and positive way. That's a lot different than most of us have experienced from managers. Most of the managers that I had, like in retail especially, they were nitpicking, they were micromanaging, they were constantly on top of everything, but ineffective at everything. And even most recently, any of the managers that I've had or anybody in that sort of executive position has had that sort of a mindset and that sort of a strategy where it's their way, but they're not including everybody in the vision and including everything and moving forward. Even nowadays, you do have like self-help books from the 80s or even more recent ones from business leaders that, yes, they were successful. Yes, they were CEOs, presidents, owners, all of these titles that they have been given by shareholders, given themselves by starting the company in the first place. But in of itself, that doesn't necessarily make them a leader. They were just successful. Like Trump is a great example. I've listened to a few of his books. They have excellent points of how to overcome others, overcome objections, and there's some excellent points about opportunity, taking opportunity. But the man himself, I mean,
he didn't write those though. Like those weren't his points.
He wrote some of it. He got feedback from some of it. I mean, like Think Big and Kick Ass, for instance, is the biggest one that comes to mind. Most of that was both, yes, it was part of it was written by him, and then yes, part of it was written up by experience.
He was interviewed for it. I'm sure there was points that he came up with.
Yeah. Anyway, let David finish.
The point being is like those still propagate today, like as examples of leaders, even though, like I was saying, a true leader is somebody that props other people up, that is able in order to include other people in the vision and moving forward and taking advantage of opportunities in order to grow whatever the organization is that they have so that everybody benefits.
Okay, good points. How about you, Chris Hamilton? What were some of the leadership skills or leadership traits that you saw being, you know, exalted when you were growing up versus not now, but when you were growing up?
Yeah, so I grew up, I feel, with a tainted perspective of what a leader should, which qualities a leader should embody. So I thought of like the classic model of like the physically tough, you know, probably the loudest person in the room, delegating tasks, leading with bravado and ego. So that was like my, you know, youth and teenage years. And then I got into, with my first field of employment, I actually worked for Overweighty Food Group, which of course is a Jim Pattison run company. And obviously that guy's like a business mogul out here. And started hearing stories about, you know, like this guy's made it to where he is because when he was a used car salesman, he would cut the, or a car salesman in general, he would, you know, fire the lowest salesman. The person with the lowest amount of sales every month would get fired. And so that guy was, you know, progressing in the business world because he had these brutal, which I consider underhanded tactics such as this. You know, he closed down a bunch of Save-On Foods and converted them over to a Price Mart Foods to break the union so that people would get paid less, so on and so forth. So as far as employment, that was my first, you know, perspective on what a leader was in the business world was somebody who just does whatever they need to do to get to where they're going. It doesn't matter how many people they trample on the way you know, any sort of, there's no sort of ethical code there. So I feel I grew up with a tainted perspective. That was my first job. And I also grew up in a small, you know, scrappy town where the dudes who were, you know, the popular guys and stuff were the guys who fought other people and things of that nature. So I kind of have this classic example of the leadership role being the person who is just like a rugged asshole who doesn't care who they trample to become the best at something.
Interesting points. And I don't think that was skewed. I think that was, I mean, it's skewed, but I don't think that your perspective and perceptions of that are that different than many of us had as far as leadership growing up. But let's talk to Andy. Andy, what were the things when you were growing? I mean, you grew up at a different time than say Paul or I.
Sure.
What were some of the perspectives you had when you were younger as to what a leader is and how that relates to masculinity?
Well, I had something completely prepared, but I have something completely different to share. In my opinion, Jim Pattison is a fucking hero. And the reason why I say this is because at a time in my life when I had no clue what I wanted to do, he met with me for an hour in his office, spent his time with me and said, what would you like to do if you could do anything? And I said, I don't know. And he said, what makes you feel like you want to say that you want to do, but you're too embarrassed to say? And I said, broadcasting. And he said, okay, we're going to help you do that. And he helped me find my way. And when I went into a station that he had owned and had met with the general manager and I was having a huge panic attack and I thought, oh, I'm horrible for this. I ended up getting an internship. And when I was there and I heard my very first, my voice on air for the first time, I thought to myself, oh my God, I sound way too gay. I will never make it in this industry. And like, it's just horrible. And I felt so ashamed and so embarrassed. And when I met Jim Pattison, again, he asked me how my internship was going. I said to him, I said, you know, and this guy is of course very conservative, you know, Christian. And I said to him, I said, you know, I'm really embarrassed because I sound too gay and I feel like I'm embarrassing you or I'm embarrassing. And he said to me, he said, here's the thing. Don't worry about me. He said, worry about your audience. If you want to talk about cars, you want to talk about sex, you want to talk about liberal issues or conservative issues, just be yourself. And he said, you can do nothing more than make me happy than to just be yourself. And when you be yourself, you'll find an audience. And for me, that was so important because I was talking to someone who is very similar to my own family, who is very Christian, conservative. And I hadn't at the age of 30, not come out to my family. So for me to be coming out to this man who basically could be in charge my entire career and have him be like, it's okay who you are. That meant the world to me. Now business, I understand. Pragmatism, there are ways things are done. It's about the bottom line, Protestant work ethic. I get it. and that can be very evil. But this is a man who would meet with, honestly, the lowest of the low, the biggest nobody, and spend an hour of his time to encourage that person's growth. And because of him, I've grown so much and been able to do so much. So I just have to say that first. But the big thing for me when I look at leadership is culture. And what culture do you create? And I feel like a lot of men would create culture, or they didn't really create culture. They just sort of expected things to be the way they should be. Whereas women are very good observers. And I find that women observe, and that's their leadership style. And they're able to make really good decisions quickly. Whereas men just expect things to be okay and to work. And when they don't work, it gets a little bit frustrating for them. So when they don't get their way, it kind of doesn't really make them all that good of a leader. So the big thing you can really reflect on is the culture that you create in your business.
All good points. I mean, the first leader that I was exposed to was the program director of the cable station that I started at when I was 14. And he postured as being hyper-masculine. He didn't have much regard for women as anything other than sexual conquests. He would brook no objections. If anybody objected to something he said, or if he said something that was clearly inaccurate and somebody tried to gently correct him or just point out something, he would fire them. He was a tyrant, and that's what I saw as management. Now, when I took over for him, I went the other direction because I saw all the errors that he made, but he was not out of step for the way leadership was perceived by men in the 80s. He was a womanizing lout, a bully, but he didn't seem out of step because you looked around and the type of leaders that were being celebrated were male and were tyrants, were bullies. So I think we've all had similar experiences with, you know, these kinds of leaders in the past. Now we jump to today, and do we see leadership changing? Do we see, and is it a result of women in the workforce, or is our perceptions just changing? What do you think, Paul?
Oh, I mean, there's always changes, and it's so strange how society sort of moves and what our norms are from one period to the next shifts all the time. And I've noticed over the course of my life, each time there's a different administration in the United States, if it's a Republican administration, except the time under Trump here, it usually becomes quite conservative. People behave more conservatively. Under Obama, it was more liberal, and under Bill Clinton, it was more liberal as opposed to the Bushes. We really have these fluctuations that happen. I think that, like in Alberta in the 80s and the 90s, I felt that it was a less hyper-masculine society than it's become. And I think it's, sort of, if anything, they've probably adopted those types of management and male attitudes that you described experiencing at the beginning of your career. And I think it's shifting all the time. But I don't think it's quite the same. I don't think we have quite the same stereotypical boxes that we can put people in for their leadership style or their management style that we used to have, because we've got such a diverse group of people now out there in the world as leaders and managers. The best managers usually are the ones who listen and lead by example, in my experience. But the psychos always seem to rise to the top. So, it's always a difficult thing. I was thinking as we were talking here about management styles that influenced me, and probably the management styles that influenced me the most are from the TV show Gilligan's Island. And you and I are maybe the only two people who have seen it, but you've got the professor who everybody ultimately defers to, and he's the one who listens and thinks and has the good ideas and relies on science. And then you've got the skipper who's a little bit of the authoritarian, but he's not too much of an authoritarian. He's still sort of trying to be balanced. The only real soldier is Gilligan. And then you've got Mr. Howell, who's the businessman, who's often, wrong about everything, but has a certain opinion and a decision that he's made. And I guess my management style is I adopt the professor wherever I can.
Well, the thing about the professor, of course, is that he could make a radio out of a banana and a bamboo pole, but he couldn't make a raft to get them off the island.
Well, I could never figure that one out either. I mean, he wasn't necessarily the best professor. There's lots of people who get a PhD who, anyway.
I knew somebody who had a PhD in athletics or something like that, physical education.
Yeah.
They were a doctor of gym. But they insisted on being told being called doctor all the time.
I had a friend in his last year of university. He had just decided he was going to take nothing but phys ed courses, and he wrote papers on them all, and so he got A+ in them because he was had a master's degree in history. He just wanted to bump up his GPA.
I think that if I tried to do something in physical education, that it would not bump up my GPA. But that's another story, and that's a personal story. Let's talk to Aaron. Aaron, what do you see as having changed in perceptions of management, and what do you attribute that to?
Well, I attributed it to the evolutions in society. Our social norms, the way we perceive each other, the groups we perceive, our ways of conduct, they're always changing. And leadership roles, whether in the workplace or in the community, will evolve with them. I think about the types of accounting firms that my father probably worked at in his 20s and 30s, where it's just accepted that the men are accountants and the women are the assistants. And that's the way it was, like in the 50 years since, we've come a long way. For me, the unique experience is kind of more tilted towards the millennials versus previous generation side of things, because we know that the ways of life of millennials, and I'm an 83 baby, I'm a sort of elder millennial, we work in different ways than our parents' generations did. And that has caused frictions, that has caused evolutions. We work in different ways now than was the case 10 years ago, because I think the workplaces that I worked in and the sort of chiefs of staff that I reported to on the Hill, there needed to be some working out of the way we deal with each other. So those evolutions always happen. For me, that's the one that sort of stands out in my mind, but I'm sure that anybody, based on their various intersections in their lives with the leaders they've had and the people they've led, can talk about the transformations they've seen along the way.
Interesting points. How about you, David? What do you think is different about management perceptions today, and why do you think they are that way?
Yeah, I think a lot of excellent points have already been brought up along the lines of whoever's the leader of the United States, the leader of Canada, whatever the political sway is, kind of affect the successful managers and successful leaders within organizations. I kind of was more thinking along the lines of like one of many reasons why I like and wanted to move forward to get into farming was in order to kind of get out of that entire mindset and that entire situation. When it comes to farming, you can't bully the ground. You can't bully nature. You can't bully and push and drive things to go faster or to go bigger or to go better. It's all a matter of everything in time. And with all the different managers that I've gone that I've had in the past, like a lot of them would bully, a lot of them would try to enforce instead of include, dictate instead of listen. And with nature, like one of the more entertaining things that I've come along with is birds, especially, because we started with about like a couple dozen birds that we actually hatched from eggs before we got the property. Like we got the property lined up and Jen was like, you know what? It would be cheaper if we just, you know, hatched our own eggs. I was like, okay, cool. Sounds good. So she got, you know, an incubator, kept an eye on it, and they hatched. A couple of them died. That's how it goes. Point being, we're now about 7-8 months into it, and some of those birds still aren't laying eggs. We put the time into it, the investment. We've made a shelter that they can stay warm in when it's negative 20, negative 25, negative 30. We fed them, provided water, and they're not going to be producing yet. In the past week, we've been blessed with a good over a dozen eggs a day. So it's all ebb and flow. It's all in its own pace. So I cycling back to management, leadership, masculinity. Yeah, that's one of many reasons why I'm doing everything I can in order to get out of that. And the best reception that we've gotten so far is from the farmers in the area. Everybody that's kind of stopped by, the usual like neighborly feeling, they raise cattle, they do all of those other things using the earth as much as possible, and they appreciate the fact that we are developing on the land, we're utilizing the land, that we've got cows, we've got birds, we're wanting in order to live off the land as well. And that's been the greatest encouragement. And I don't know if that's a feeling of leadership or a better ideal of leadership, but that's one of many reasons that I've really been enjoying this transition.
Okay, thank you for the farm report. What about you, Hafiz? What are your thoughts on the subject?
On leadership? How it's changed.
How it's changing, how it's changed, and why.
I think people are less ready to take bullshit from people these days. And that's where it's really changed. And you have a generation of people that have grown up with their parents, coming home stressed and broken and tired. And we've said that, you know, we're not going to take this. And I think especially when I hit the workforce in the 2000s, you really saw that change because David and I both worked at Radio Shack. That's where we met way back in the day. And there was definitely that old school managerial type and then sort of the more laid back type. And you really saw how effective that was. And these guys that were these super alpha types that try to, you know, dominate everyone and try to make this sales environment that was really uber stressful, they didn't do too well. They mostly failed. And the guys that managed to put together teams that were laid back and, you know, the stores that had a mix of women in there actually did well. And it was interesting because, I mean, I didn't notice it then, but we were one of the first few Radio Shacks that were actually hiring women. And I think that has definitely brought about a change because I don't think that mentality of bringing people down does anyone good. And real leadership is about bringing people up. And that's the new focus. And I think the modern leader very much has to be more part of in the team and doing things for your group to bring the most out of them.
Interesting points. So it's both generational and the fact that more women are having an impact on the workforce then, in your opinion.
Absolutely. And you know what? I've seen even what women bring into the leadership role as well. I've had some fantastic leaders that are women. And they change the dynamic a little bit. And I notice that especially when you have like, you know, a group of managers and there's one that's a woman, that really changes the whole group because they, even though they might not look at her as an equal, will start to notice that she has certain successes that they want to bring out of their people and they'll adapt their style. Now, I've also seen it go the other way where you see some women try to pull in more masculine roles and be more dominant. And sometimes that backfires. The thing is, no one wants that dude from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that was a complete asshole. You know, the guy from working 9 to 5 that, you know, takes advantage of all his employees, treats them like shit, and then acts like a saint in front of his management, right? That era is done. And when you really look at people that, you know, you might think of as tough leaders, when it comes down to it, when they're actually working with people, they get down to a level of being personal with people. And that doesn't always happen when you look at these more domineering types that are trying to put on this role. Whereas the guys that are actually the sort of the characteristic that these alphas want to look up to are way more laid back.
Interesting points. What about you? What do you think, Chris? What are your thoughts on this subject?
Yeah, I mean, as the social norms change or swing a little bit to the left, I feel like there's a lot of millennials in the workforce, for example, and they're more sensitive than, you know, dudes growing up in the 70s and 80s, I feel, and not for the wrong reasons either. Yeah, like nobody wants to be berated in the workforce into doing a better job, and nobody wants to work under that system of fear. Where if you don't pull your weight, you're going to be canned the next day. I find that the people who are successful as managers in my industry, which I do work in the sales industry, are the people who can manage as friends rather than as bosses. I mean, there's a time and a place to put your foot down and exert some authority. But a lot of the people entering the workforce right now are going to, you know, going to jive a little bit better with people who are friendly opposed to people who are authoritarian. In politics, I found that this trait was prevalent in Jack Layton. He made me interested in politics. I previously had no political affiliation. And when Jack Layton took over leadership of the NDP, I looked at this guy and I said, I could be friends with that guy. Like, he was a dude who got a whole generation of people who were disenfranchised with politics into paying attention to politics. So to me, that was a good example of what a leader should be like. And I've been blessed in my field of employment to have landed under a parent company that exhibit these exact same qualities. So one of my bosses, great man, he looked at me one day, he said, Chris, I'd rather be your friend than your boss. And that to me, it just garnered loyalty through and through. I looked up to that guy from that day forward, and all of my management team that oversee my operations are exhibiting the same qualities. So I'm not really the type of person to, you know, like jive with somebody who's going to yell at me and try to belittle me into doing a better job. I'm kind of going to, you know, gel better with people who are friendly and, you know, want to work with me to achieve the common good of whatever the endeavor is.
It's interesting. I've been in management positions, senior management positions in the past, and I've always said that boss is a verb, not a noun. It's similar to what you're talking about. You treat people like human beings rather than cogs in a machine. And you'll get people who think and act like human beings, including their creative endeavors, their enthusiasm, the kind of things you don't get out of cogs.
I actually went on to work for the NDP when I was working, when I was living in Vancouver, and I worked for Kennedy Stewart, who is now mayor of Vancouver, and worked closely with him on his campaign. I wouldn't say boo, he's a great guy. On his campaign.
Isn't about politics. Shut up, Hafiz.
When he was running for MP during Justin Trudeau's ascend to the throne there. And Kennedy Stewart was a great guy. He did manage exactly like that. He was our friend. He sat down and ate food with us before the shift and debriefed it with us at the end of the day. He was not authoritarian in any way. And generally looked up to him as well, despite Hafiz's booze.
Well, Hafiz's booze are on a political level. You're talking more on a human level. So that you're talking about two different things. Andy, you've been listening. Hello. You've been listening patiently. What are your thoughts on how you have seen the precepts and the perceptions of what is good management change over the years? And why do you think that is?
So I'm in my fourth year of university and I've been writing lots of papers. And when I was doing some research, I stumbled upon the BC Treaty Commission's Policy and Procedures Guide. So that basically sets forth like Indigenous treaties and how they are negotiated and resolved if there's any sort of dispute. And there's six stages. And what I noticed is that it informs consent at each stage. And I'm seeing like in Sweden, they have a huge consensus culture and people are always checking in. Sweden is the land of the meetings. And I'm noticing in British Columbia or in Canada, North America at large, we're really getting closer towards a consensus culture, and Indigenous frameworks are going to be informing, I think, our future for how we perform in the workplace and in many other arenas. And I think we're really getting closer to a consensus culture. You're seeing this happen through our through like call out culture or people trying to have a voice. I think it's important for people to have input in the workplace, But from a management style, I think, you know, there has to be a point where there has to be like a central point figure that will make the decision, and people have to respect and work with that decision. So I think we're working towards a consensus culture. It is looking at a point where people are checking in, giving in their input. People are respected in the workplace and heard. This is like the number one cause of disputes, is people don't feel heard or respected or valued. So I think we're going to be working towards that, and ultimately being strong leaders and being able to make a decision and then work with it.
Okay, good points. And as a final, I want to ask each of you to name a leader that you worked for, worked with, and the one that stands out as being perhaps the most instructive or most inspirational. I'll back up and start with you, Andy. Why don't we start with you instead of ending with you?
Sure. Gee whiz. I really liked Hank Hill on King of the Hill. I thought he was a pretty cool leader.
I said who you worked for or worked with, not who you watched on TV.
You know what? Gee whiz. I think most of the managers I know at one point or another want to go home and blow their brains out because life just sucks and they feel they've lost some form of agency in the world. I think the people that can fail and move forward and be able to still keep the respect and care of the people around them is someone that I enjoy. You know what I'm waiting for? I'm really waiting to go to grad school and like get my law degree and like kind of get into that field of people, because I enjoy policy and procedure, but lawyers are wild people and I kind of want to see how they govern themselves. I kind of want to do like a little field study on that. Paul, maybe I can come by the office one day.
As soon as the pandemic's over. You come on in.
We'll give you a never.
All right. What about you, David Lisney? Any manager in particular that really stood out and inspired you or taught you things?
Yep. Brad Girard. He developed a life insurance agency, basically. But the inspirational part was he was a complete introvert to the point that public speaking, like what we're doing right now, absolutely frozen in his tracks. But for him, in order to grow and in order to develop an agency, the only way he could do that is standing in front of people and talking about his story. And early on, he would be in the washroom ahead of the meeting and just shaking, throwing up, just had to overcome this like week after week, year after year, in order to become the person that he was. And when I was introduced to him, he had grown the business to like 750,000 of revenue every single year. But he grew from such awkward position that it was a true inspiration. And I learned a lot about leadership versus management through him.
Okay, good. how about you, Chris Hamilton, special manager?
Yeah, I think I answered that question with the last response there when I talked about both Kennedy and my current bosses. So I'll just move forward with naming a couple qualities that I do see as being leadership worthy. So not the loudest person in the room, leading by example. I think Paul mentioned that earlier. Leads by example, not by exerting one's ego. Don't have to necessarily be the best at doing something to be the leader at it. Just got to, you know, be explanatory and also remaining teachable and striving for improvement at one's given task. And humility, biggest quality of a leader would be humility.
Okay, good points. What about you, Paul?
There's two managers I can think of I worked under who were both very impressive to me. One was Steve Richards, who is still a friend of mine 30 years later. I worked with him at the Auto Trader. It was like he was a mid-manager, working part of the time in the publishing print shop. And, you know, he would get in there with us. He would do the work with us. He was stoic about it. He would listen to your problems and he would think about it. And, he was more than willing to assist wherever, but he really led by example and he wanted to do a good job. And it was, you know, he knew that this was just a stepping stone for him, but he didn't want to push anybody else down. He wanted to get the job done and he was very reasonable about it. And he pushed us hard. We got a lot of work done. We were very efficient because of him. Similarly, I had a manager named Jerry, and I can't remember his last name, but he managed the Canadian Tire in West Edmonton Mall at one point. And he went on to become a Canadian Tire franchise owner. And I'm sure he was a great franchise owner because he was a very smart guy and dealt with it similarly. Like, he would get in there. If the toilet was plugged, you know, and nobody wanted to go in there, he'd be the one who would grab the plunger and go do it. And, you know, it's the story of my life here in the office, too. I mean, if the garbage has to go out, I'll be in here after hours to take the garbage out. And I try and lead by example. And I think, you know, my staff get that. And, you know, I learned that from those two gentlemen.
Okay, good. Also, really good examples. Aaron?
Yeah, for me, there are six names. The political leaders, as I talked about earlier, Harper, Flaherty, and Clement, the three ministers I worked for, and they were all different, and I take different things from them. And on the business side, at that small call center that I worked at in my late teenage years, three women, Roselyne was the VP, Hélène was the general manager, and Lise was my direct supervisor. And each one of them influenced me in different ways. And Roselyne and Hélène both held MBAs, and they were the ones who I studied and started to wonder, where did you learn these lessons and what more do I need to learn? And when I took my own MBA in 2013 and 14, I started to draw some links to those experiences to those two women. So those six names are the ones that stand out for me. They're sort of the six-headed monster that forms the inspirational leader that you were asking about, Stephen.
Okay. Hafiz?
I had the benefit to work for this individual named Mr. Sam. He was actually my friend's dad, Sam Ramadan, and or Ramson. They owned a business development firm, and I got to see a little bit of the world with them. And it was just sort of the leadership style, because I'd worked for, you know, corporate offices before, but this was the first time where there was no use of sort of domineering force, and it was more sort of a teamwork environment. And I think that really changed my perspective of the corporate world and how it should really be. It was this type of thing where everyone comes together on a project and works on helping the other person finish what they're trying to do and doing it right. For someone, this particular gentleman, he'd seen a lot of wealth in his time and seen the world through connections that, you know, I'd never even dream of in the Middle East. And for him to be so humble about it really set my my mind in a different direction. Because I see a lot of people in sort of jobs that, aren't very prestigious, acting like complete knobs towards their employees. And for someone to who has so much to not have that attitude really says a lot.
Good points also. And for me, there's two people that come to mind. One, his name is Steve Jacobs, and he taught me everything not to do. And sometimes that is as important or more important than people who show you by example what to do, because sometimes those examples get lost on you. But when you see all the ways not to manage, not to lead, that really leaves an indelible mark on you. So I appreciate him for that and nothing else. And on the flip side, a gentleman I worked for, he was the vice president of programming when I was working in cable TV. His name is Bill Hunt. And Bill was someone who you never questioned his authority, but he never took himself so seriously. He never took umbrage at anybody questioning his thoughts or criticizing them, or if as long as you had some meat to your criticism, and as long as, especially if you had some alternative. He was self-effacing. He had a sense of humor. He was great at spotting talent and then letting that talent do what they were talented at, as opposed to constantly micromanaging. And he would let you take a flyer sometimes when he wasn't 100% sure, but he would put his trust in his people's perceptions and let them take a shot at something he wasn't completely seeing the same way they were, but he had trust in his people enough to let them do it. And it worked out more times than it didn't, but he was affable, a good sense of humor. And, even though he was approachable with an open door, you still never questioned that he was the guy in charge. Somehow, even though he could be challenged, he let you challenge him, and he didn't take himself seriously, and he would let you kid around with him. You still never questioned who was in charge. And I found that to be a really important skill, being able to be personable and be human while still maintaining that level of authority. Bill taught me an awful lot with that. So we've all learned some very important lessons from our, well, they're, in many ways, they're our mentors, whether we recognized it or not. They taught us things. And learning from their experience and gaining experience from watching them has been the kind of thing that separates people succeeding from failing, because you got to learn from both the good examples and the bad examples, and having the chance to learn at the foot of somebody who's who's good at what they do or terrible at what they do. It's really advantageous for us and really helps us stand on the shoulders of giants. Even sometimes we're standing on the shoulders of pygmies. It still helps with our perspective. So I want to thank all of you for talking about leadership today. Hafiz Narani, our producer, thank you very much.
You are very welcome.
David Lisney, our hobby farmer, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Our MC, Chris Hamilton, Illtones Music, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, Stephen.
Always glad to have you. Our legal expert, Paul Doroshenko, thank you, Paul.
Thanks a lot. Great insights this week. Thanks, everyone.
Of course, our resident government survivor and entrepreneur, Aaron Seal, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And of course, the ineffable, irrepressible Andrew Willis. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you so much. And please, please buy your turkey this Christmas at Save On Foods. Jim Patterson would love it very much.
This is why I go to you last.
Okay. 5 employees get fired. There you go.
All right. We'll leave it there. If you've enjoyed this show, please support us. $5 a month at patreon.com/FUNetworkTV or a one-time donation at PayPal. Our PayPal address is funetworktv@gmail.com. For the Fun Network, for Mensplaining, I'm Stephen Kersner. Thank you for listening. For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow. Let's all say on the bus.